The president has been complaining in recent weeks about the nature of the reporting which has been sent back by the print media and television from El Salvador. He seems to be making the case that the reporters who flocked down to this tragic land have brought with them their own prejudices, largely an inability to see evil on the left, and that the reporting has reflected not the reality of the situation, but an ideology or concerns which these reporters had long before they arrived in El Salvador. Now, I have no way of knowing if this be true or if it not be true. But I do know this, that the reporters who have been in El Salvador have almost, to a man, to a person, given us the surface of the events rather than the substance of the events, the foreground rather than the background. They remind me more of reporters on the police beat in the inner city of Cleveland or New York, who race after the police cars to the scene of the murder and quickly take a picture of the corpse before it's hauled away to the morgue, and then thrust a tape recorder and a microphone in the face of the widow and ask her how she's feeling, and then perhaps find the head of the local street gang who may or may not have been involved in the shooting. I think all of us were surprised at the turnout of voters last Sunday. And we were surprised because the reports, television and the news reports, had told us about the threats of the left to disrupt the elections, had shown us night after night pictures of the shootings by the left in various towns in El Salvador, so much so that we became convinced that if we were in El Salvador, we'd never go to the polls, and therefore no Salvadorian would dare to go to the polls, or few would indeed. And when more Salvadorians went to the polls proportionately than Americans did in the last presidential election, nearly 1,300,000 people voted, we were not prepared for the numbers who went and who voted, nor were we prepared to understand what they meant by their vote. All that we really knew about the elections in El Salvador was that there was an election. And no one seems to have wondered about the fact, at least among the reporters, that there were at least six parties competing for votes. And six parties must mean six different platforms or planks or attitudes or personalities. And we were given none of that in our news. In preparation for this morning, I've been reading very carefully the national news magazines, the major newspapers, and watching a good bit of the news coverage on television. And it wasn't until 4 days after the election, Wednesday of this week, that I found any piece in the print media which gave you a thumbnail profile, or any profile indeed, of the positions and the personalities involved in these six contesting parties. What we had instead was the use of a few labels, right, center, left, without any indication of the political matrix or the economic matrix or the ideological matrix against which these labels were being given to us. The party of the Christian Democrats, of José Duarte, was called a centrist party. Now, in the last 2.5 years, ever since this civilian military junta came to power in a non-democratic way, simply by seizing power, it has engaged in a number of activities. It has appropriated the 12 or 1,300 largest land holdings or plantations in El Salvador and has tried to create in them peasant communes. It has nationalized the banking system and guaranteed the government control, 51% of control, of the major banks of the country. It has nationalized the sale of two of the three major cash crops of El Salvador, coffee and cotton. Now, if I were sitting in the Union Club in Cleveland and talking to the well-to-do who frequent those halls, I doubt that they would call a party which nationalizes the banks, a centrist party. They would have far more radical terms for this kind of socialist, if not communist, activity. So what do we mean when we speak of a centrist party? What do we mean when we speak of a left party of the left? Do we mean a party dedicated to the kinds of principles that the Democratic Party in the United States is dedicated to? Concerns for government's help to those who are least fortunate in the society, the reform of the economy of the society, so that all can enjoy its opportunity through evolutionary and reformist means? Or do we mean a party which is determined not to trust the ballot, not to trust the people to vote for them, but to try and win its place in control in order to achieve its economic reforms by at gunpoint? Who represents the left? The Marxist terrorists who are in the fields, the poor 14, 15-year-old guerrillas who are in the fields who have been given a gun and know that they have an enemy who has more than they do? Some of the politicians who have fled into exile, who have one or another ideology which made them persona non grata in their own country? And what of the right? The right has been presented to us in the media largely as a party determined to suppress dissent at all costs and not to negotiate with the guerrillas. But why then are there five parties on the right? What does the right represent? Now, obviously, there is a party on the right, the party that received the majority of those votes, which is associated with a strong man, a caudillo in traditional Latin American fashion by the name of Roberto d'Aubusson. And this man has said that in 3 months he would stamp out the terrorist activity, he'd use napalm and any other kind of weapon that he had to. And clearly, many among the traditional privileged and the frightened of El Salvador want to see law and order established, reestablished, at whatever the cost. But there are five other parties, supposedly on the right. Why do they differ if the position is simply to stamp out the violence in the country? The second largest party is a party of democratic conciliation, as it's called. It represents the military leaders who governed El Salvador, for the most part, in the post-war era. And we tend to associate a military government with repression and tyranny and an anti-democratic approach. But in Latin America, and this is true to a certain degree, obviously, in that part of the world, but it's also true that in Latin America, the military has been one of the ways in which the sons of the poor, the sons of the lower middle class, could move up in the society. The society expanded in terms of its economy and its prosperity. And most of the military are children of the lower classes. And the military, therefore, has interest in many of these reforms, quite as much as Duarte and his own party. And not all of them want to do what d'Aubusson wants to do, and that is to roll back the clock to the time when 14 families ruled El Salvador as if it were their own private possession. What I'm saying is simply that we have not been given by our media the information, the wherewithal to judge what is happening in that part of the world. We've been given what is on the surface, what is photographable, the incident. Many of those reporters could have done far better for us if they'd gone to the libraries in the United States rather than to rush down into El Salvador and to find a jeep and to try and rush out in the fields every time there's a gunfight between one or another of the private armies that are in the field down there. I remember when the Six-Day War was taking place in Israel. And again, the reporters of the world flocked to Israel. Most of them didn't speak Hebrew. They didn't speak Arabic. They had no knowledge of the historical background of the situation. And so they would sit in the bar of the King David Hotel exchanging their stories about whatever incidents had occurred that day and file back to the United States a news report or some pictures which showed a firefight, which showed the advance of the Israeli army armored units, or which showed some protest by the Arabs in Gaza or the West Bank. It's information without understanding. There's no principle of coherence to it. I often wondered as I watched this group of correspondents and columnists descend upon El Salvador, how many spoke Spanish? How many could go out and speak the Indian tongues and go out into the tribes and find out what it is they were really feeling? How many would go out and would talk to some average people to understand why they were voting and what they thought they were voting for and what the issues were as they perceived it? You know, we ought all to be sensitized now to what we might call the Sadat syndrome. In the West, in the United States particularly, Sadat was a great hero. He was the hero of Camp David. He's the man who'd gone to Jerusalem. He'd established the first break, he managed the first breakthrough in the wall of silence which had excluded Israel in the Arab world from any ability to deal with another country of that part of the world. But when one looked at Sadat from his own citizens' point of view domestically, the Egyptians clearly saw another kind of leader, a man who was increasingly indifferent to their economic needs, who couldn't solve the problems of inflation, whose family was taking economic advantage of the power that was theirs. And the world was shocked when Sadat was assassinated to see how little really the average Egyptian cared for, mourned for, the man whom the West mourned so much. And so again, we have been fed what little we have been fed of information from El Salvador in terms of what it means to the United States. And you can't understand a domestic political upheaval unless one understands it in situ, what it means in its own situation, in its own time and place, and among the actors who are there in the field. And so what I'd like to do this morning is to tell you as best I can what I've been able to piece together as a kind of background map of the events in El Salvador, to give you a framework in which I have found useful in trying to understand what is happening there. I warn you at the beginning that I have no solution to the problems of El Salvador. I don't believe there is a solution to their problems. Whatever will work out there will require a great deal of time and effort and patience and compromise, and that's not the nature of the Latin temperament. But in any case, let's understand what's involved before we make quick judgments one way or another as to what the United States or the world or the United Nations or we ought to do about it. When one reads the history of El Salvador, one is almost convinced that God never intended El Salvador to emerge as a nation. During the Indian years, El Salvador was simply one of those forest areas through which the Mayans and other Indian tribes roamed. There's no relationships between the boundaries of El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Guatemala, and Indian territorial limits. And then when the Spanish conquered Latin America in the early 16th century, El Salvador was simply part of the captaincy of Guatemala. It was ruled from Guatemala City. It was, the church had its headquarters in Guatemala City. The Inquisition was centered there. And from 1524 to the 1820s, El Salvador was simply a piece of territory, a minor province of the Guatemalan provincial center. During that period, however, profound changes took place in the Indian culture. Spanish became the language of the country. The Roman Catholic Church became the state religion of the country. The attitudes of the royalist Spain and of an aristocratic church had their impact upon generation and have pretty well blotted out any ability to have a democratic conscience emerge. What emerged was an ability to accept orders and to accept the rightfulness of those in authority. And a plantation economy emerged. The main cash crops and resources of El Salvador, the territory which became El Salvador in those years, were indigo and balsam, and a little bit of gold and silver that were mined in some rather meager lodes that were found in the mountains. In 1821, Latin America achieved its independence of a Spain which had been overrun and then was preoccupied by the Napoleonic Wars. And in 1831, El Salvador, or rather the few plantation owners of El Salvador, declared independence of the provincial center, the capital in Guatemala City, largely because they didn't want to pay the taxes which Guatemala traditionally imposed upon them. Nothing much occurred during most of the 19th century. It was a backward, rather impoverished part of the world. El Salvador has no port on the Atlantic, and what little it produced, it sold up and down the Pacific coast or paid tolls to sell it to Europe or to the east coast of the United States. And then in the early 1880s, El Salvador emerged because in Europe and in the United States, coffee suddenly became a most desirable drink. The Constitution of 1886, which is the basic constitution of El Salvador, is the only constitution in the world which is the result of the coffee break. As Europe became entranced by coffee, El Salvador discovered that its soil and its climate were uniquely disposed to the growing of the coffee bean. The only problem was that most of the land which was best suited to coffee, which became a very important cash crop, were the hillsides. And the traditional plantation owners had farmed the bottom land, the rich valley land. They not bothered with the hillsides, which they had allowed to remain as reservations, tribal preserves owned in common by the tribes. And so now the tribes were in possession of the richest, potentially the richest land in El Salvador. So what did the wealthy do? They gave them a constitution. And the constitution guaranteed elections, a unicameral legislation, and private property. And the only thing that the wealthy were interested in was private property. They knew they could control the legislature and the vote. The peasants and the Indians were illiterate. And so what they did was to give each of the peasants a piece of script which said that he had 15 acres or 20 acres of land on the hillside. Go farm it. And the now this owner of land had his piece of paper, but he didn't have money for seed. And he didn't have money for tools, and so he fell prey to the money lenders. And by 1900, 40% of the land of El Salvador, almost all the arable land, certainly all the land which was useful for coffee, was in the hands of 2% of the population, the non-tribal people, the non-Indian people, the old aristocrats. And that situation lasted down into the 1970s. It wasn't until the last few years that these plantations were broken up under the land reform of the Duarte Junta. Constitutions are not always what they seem to be. They can be used by people to achieve greedy ends, as well as used by societies which are determined to create a social compact for democratic ends. El Salvador now had achieved the shape economically and politically that would remain its shape until the end of the Second World War. But during this period of time, a bit of prosperity came to the country, and with a bit of prosperity, the cities, and with cities, there emerged a group of people who were trained in the free professions, a group of peasants who'd come up through the military to positions of power. You began to get a middle class, a group that you hadn't had before. And somehow between the 1880s and the 1970s, illiteracy dropped from 80% to 40%. 6,000, 7,000 miles of roads were built. 2 railroads crossed the country. And though the population of the country exceeds its capacity really to support a society, there are 4.8 million of people in El Salvador. It has a higher population density per square mile than India. And though the per capita domestic income is something around $600, one of the lowest in Latin America, changes were taking place. There was a sense of growth, there was a sense of opportunity, and those who have worked in that country speak of people who are industrious and who are trying as best they could under very difficult situations to make a better life for themselves. Now here we have a society in which there is no democratic tradition, in which neither the culture, nor the religion, nor the political forms are conducive to the emergence of a democracy, which has traditionally been governed by a few aristocratic families in an oligarchical form of government, society which is slowly developing some prosperity and some opportunity. And then in 1930, suddenly the process of election began to take on serious proportions. A man named Artur Arujo was elected as the president of El Salvador, a man who had ideas about social reform. And more amazingly still, the oligarchical families allowed him to enter his office. But he had bad luck. He came into office just before the Great Depression swept over the world. Coffee prices plummeted. He lacked the ability to pay for the social reforms which he envisaged, the schools, the hospitals, and whatnot. And he faced, as the present government does, from the extreme left, a challenge. An Indian, young Indian chief by the name of Marty had been captivated by the success of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. He'd become a Marxist. And he led a group of young Indians into open rebellion, hoping to overthrow this oligarchical society. And this provided the right with the excuse to go into the field to remove Arujo as incompetent, as Duarte was claimed to be just a year or so ago, and to cruelly and violently put down the Indian rebellion and thus end this first attempt at some kind of democratic government. And so the situation remained through the 30s to the end of the Second World War. At the end of the Second World War, this middle class had emerged to the point where they were beginning to demand their economic place in the sun, if not some degree of political freedom. And there were all kinds of clashes and minor skirmishes. And the general who was the president of the country at the time, a man named Hernandez, for a while tried to suppress these militarily. And then in 1946, he finally decided that he couldn't kill everybody in El Salvador. And so he resigned and did what most of the wealth of El Salvador has traditionally done, that is to take the money which he'd already sent to Miami and to Geneva and to leave the country. One of the tragedies of El Salvador is that such wealth as was developed in the country has always been taken out by those who owned the control of that wealth. And El Salvador in the post-war years has moved through a bizarre and strange variety of juntas, military governments, an occasional democratically elected leadership which didn't last in office very long. But one could see emerging from below several things. The emergence of a new class of literate people who would be able to take authority into their own hands ultimately. The emergence of greater prosperity until the late 1970s. The gross national product in El Salvador was increasing by about 4% a year. And if it had not been for the Roman Catholic tradition of El Salvador, which precluded birth control, which made it impossible for some control of population growth, so the population has grown throughout this period by about 3.5% a year, outgrown the ability of industry or technology or agriculture to provide for the country. If it had not been for that, one might have seen a real explosion of prosperity in what had been, up till then, a very benighted part of the world. And then in the early 1970s, there was another election, and Duarte and a number of others were elected by popular vote, and they began to talk a little bit about various reforms, and the right wing immediately got frightened and deposed them and threw Duarte into prison and tortured him and cut off several of his fingers in the process, and he was sent off into exile. But because it's a small country and because politics are a churning kind of activity in that part of the world and with a tradition of violence, it was not long before the military found that they could not simply reimpose the past. And they tried for a while to walk a middle way between the Daubuissons, whom they cashiered from the army, who were the extremists, the men who wanted to return to the 19th century, and between what they considered the radicals off there on the left. They weren't able to manage this, and in 1979, Duarte and others in a civilian military junta, which was somewhat reform-minded, overthrew the military government and entered into the office which they will relinquish now, given these elections. The United States at this period of time began to be very concerned with Latin America for reasons outside of El Salvador's border because of Nicaragua and the success of the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. And we began to be interested in economic reform, social reform to a degree we had not been interested before. It fit in with President Carter's concern with human rights. And land reform and social reform was to a large degree undertaken by Duarte under tremendous pressure from the United States government. But undertaken it was, and now suddenly this man who was forced to do many of these things, whose government was forced to do it, is seen as a great democratic hero by the press in the United States. In the last 3 years, as change began to take hold of the society, the right wing began to, in traditional fashion, try to abort reform, change. And there are a number of private and semi-private armies in Latin America and in El Salvador, and these went out and began to terrorize the countryside, to murder those who disagreed with them. And terror on the right bred terror on the left, counter-terror. And the great middle, who voted in this last election largely, found themselves caught between the thugs on the one side and the thugs on the other side. And that's one of the tragic legacies of El Salvador's past, that no one really trusts the ballot, no one really trusts the courts. There has been no system of due process which has established itself in society. Justice is established in El Salvador and has always been established in El Salvador at the point of a gun. The aristocratic families had absolute control of the lives of their peasantry, life and death control. If a man did not do what his master ordered him to do, instantly he could be shot and his master would never be brought before for trial or for judgment. And that tradition remains. And so every group has in one way or another some kind of protection. And by protection, one means army, bodyguard. And there is the great danger that El Salvador will become the Lebanon of Latin America, that it will become the country in which every little group will have its private army, and ultimately every little group will hunker down in some province or town or area. And instead of having a society, one will have a group of medieval-like communities, castles, each with drawn-up drawbridges, trying desperately to hang on to what they already have. The last 3 or 4 years, the growth of prosperity in El Salvador has been aborted. 800,000 of the Salvadorians, it's estimated, have left the country, not necessarily permanently, but have left. Women and children have been sent out by those in government and by those of wealth. The wealthy have gone to Florida, to London, and elsewhere. And the country has lost in the process not only some of the people who were determined to turn back the clock, but some of the best of the technocrats, of the engineers, of the administrators, the people who could help the Salvadoran economy emerge from its relative primitiveness into the modern world. It's a real tragedy. And the tragedy is, of course, now that the elections have taken place, that there is the danger that those who want to turn back the clock will be able to claim a democratic mandate for their activity and will try, unsuccessfully, I believe, ultimately, to return El Salvador to the control of the few who know what is best for the Salvadorian world. The United States is confused. We sponsored the elections, and now we really don't like the consequences of the election. We're trying very hard, clearly, to use whatever power we can to see to it that some government of national unity is established. We may or may not be successful in that. If we are, many of the people whom we have worked through in the last 2 or 3 years will have only minor office, certainly. And there is no guarantee that such a coalition would not quickly become unglued. If we are unsuccessful, and the Daubuisson kind of approach becomes the dominant one in the government, there is great danger of both increased bloodshed and an attempt to turn back the clock of reform. And there is equal danger that, as always, repression on the right will lead to a further escalation of violence from the left, and that murder and death will again sweep over the land. Some 30,000 El Salvadorians have been killed in the fighting just in the last 3 years. What's for it? What can we do? I'm not sure that there's much that America can do. Clearly, we have to try to maintain those groups which are willing to push forward with the changes that society needs. Clearly, we ought to be doing what we can to expose the Salvadorian world to the possibilities of emerging as a free society. Certainly, we ought to do what we can to give them the breathing room, the peace which would enable them to at least become again a semi-prosperous, emerging society. But how to do that without strengthening the forces who are antithetical to most of what we instinctively stand for is an unresolved enigma. How to support law and order without supporting the kinds of people who stand for hard-fisted law and order in El Salvador. Roberto d'Aubuisson is a murderer. He was implicated as the mastermind of the murder of the Roman Catholic Archbishop of San Salvador, Archbishop Romero, a year and a half ago. This is hardly the kind of man of which we would hope to see our country associated with. And yet, here's that dilemma. His party got 29% of the vote. It's the major party of the so-called right, and he clearly will have a significant voice in the affairs of that party. He was so much of a strong man, so contemptuous of democratic procedures, in whatever terms that means in El Salvador, that the army itself 4 years ago cashiered him because he was both insubordinate and uncontrollable. Whom shall we support, and how shall we support them? And how much will Salvador listen to a United States position? We act as if we are the major source of economic and political aid to Salvador. I don't know how many of you noticed an article just 2 days ago in the paper which indicated that in the last 4 years, both Venezuela and Mexico have given more foreign aid to Salvador than we have. We like to think of ourselves as powerful, but in terms of that which allows the economy to survive and to maintain itself, other countries have been more generous to that benighted country than we, in fact, have. And clearly, in Venezuela and in Mexico particularly, there is a consensus that the hard-line anti-communist position taken by the Reagan administration is not the kind of position which is likely to gain time or to be successful in El Salvador. How does one support whatever that middle consists of? How does one see to it that basic political and economic reforms so necessary in that part of the world are in fact carried out without supporting forces whose basic purposes are quite inimical to our own? That's one of the great problems that we face. And the other problem that we face is the problem of our own impatience. We want solutions. We want them to be quick. The cost of dollars, we'll spend the dollars, but we want solutions. I suspect that in El Salvador, given its tragic history, given the lack of a democratic conscience and consensus, given the existence of all the private armies that are in the field down there, given the wide difference in ideology which separates people in the society, given the deep personal hates and the cult of vengeance which is part of that world, I doubt that in our lifetime there's going to be any solution to the problems of El Salvador. Change is taking place. With prosperity comes education. With education becomes a demand for one's civil rights. But that's still a process. 40% of El Salvador is still totally illiterate. Many of the people of El Salvador have never been in a city. Many have never been beyond their own little village up in the hills. We need to buy time. We need to have patience. We need to recognize that there is no quick fix to the political and economic problems which face this benighted part of the world. And we need to recognize that we do not control the destiny of El Salvador any more than we control the destiny of Vietnam. What ultimately will determine the fate of El Salvador is the Salvadorian people themselves. And if they do not opt for the kind of government which we would prefer, maybe we're going to have to find a way to live with that. Certainly we will have to find a way to live with that. For those who have easy solutions, on the left, those who say to us, let's prevent all arms from flowing to El Salvador. Those on the right who say, let's arm the Salvadorians, and it's only by arming the Salvadorians that there will be peace. I would say that both these positions are misguided. The one will give the field to those who will arm the other side, the other extreme. The others will give arms which will ultimately come to the hands of the private armies who are determined to undermine all the values which we hold dear. And so we must enter into long, difficult, endless negotiations, use whatever suasive power, economic power our aid brings with it, meet with the governments of Latin America who can give us guidance in this part of the world, Venezuela, Mexico, and others, avoid the labels that come so easily to the Hagues and to the Weinbergers and to the Reagans, right, left, center, for us, against us in a global sense, and try as best we can to understand the complex, difficult, intricate, contradictory politics of this little country. Find a way to keep abreast of the situation and hope that we can, acting this way and that way, supporting those that need support, shoring up those who ought to be shored up, working with those who seem to be working in ways that we approve, hoping that ultimately that society will have the opportunity to emerge and become a decent and secure place in which people can live with some measure of peace. Am I sanguine? Not really. By 1990, there'll be 6 million people in El Salvador. By the year 2000, there'll be 8 million people in El Salvador. The society simply cannot provide food, opportunity for that number. El Salvador desperately needs birth control. It desperately needs some freedom from the autocracy of church law. The church has taken a very interesting role, and I close with this, in El Salvador. As you know, many of the priests and nuns of the Roman Catholic Church, particularly those from Europe and North America, have taken very liberal and sometimes radical positions in favor of even of the guerrillas in the field. And certainly the church has been in a position to see the violence and to see the poverty and to be concerned that the reforms are not always achieving what they're intended to achieve, or in fact, that the society has avoided reform if it at all could. The church has been, in that sense, a force for good in El Salvador. But at the same time, it is a force which has created much of the problem. It has, because of its own theology, it believes that one ought not to teach birth control, that the society, the population, is not the problem, but the population is the problem. And until that population problem is solved, ultimately, whatever solutions, partial solutions, are evolved politically will be undermined, because there will always be too many families, too many mouths to feed, too many minds to educate, too many bodies to heal, too many jobs to provide, and society will never be able to catch up with its own inner growth. Once cells begin to expand in a geometric way, we have cancer. Once population begins to expand in a geometric way, we have a cancer in the body politic. And once cancer spreads through the body of a nation, it's very, very difficult to find any way of securing peace and justice in society in that nation. And so the problems are not in El Salvador, are not only political and economic, but they are cultural and religious. It's a tragedy. It's a challenge. And we can only pray that ultimately the Salvadorian people themselves will find ways to change, to grow, to bring peace and a measure of justice to their world. Amen.